Well, I'm going to make up for Tom because I've got enough slides for both of us. And even though my name's the only one on the paper, I have some people that helped me with this presentation, provided information. Paul Bergner, our ag economist, Daryl Martin, our ag engineer in Lincoln, Steve Sabray, our groundwater hydrogeologist, and Ken Kassman, my colleague in Lincoln. How many of you are older than 53? Okay, so you probably were around in 73 to be in line when the Arab oil embargo hit in 1973. I was in Cornell at grad school, and we saw this dramatic jump in prices. There was great consternation because we learned that we were importing 50% of our oil. And after 40 years, we're in much better shape. Takes a minute for it to sink in, right? Today, 66% of the oil for the U.S. comes from outside of the U.S. So we haven't made much progress. So looking back 40 years and what happened in the 1970s, and I was in the National Guard, so I didn't have big hair. it looks just like this. But we saw the beginnings of the environmental movement. There were world population concerns. And if you lived at that time, the big controversies were the discussions of Malthusian theory and massive world food shortages. And the way that we were going to address that, we really weren't sure. But luckily, along came the Green Revolution and cheaper fertilizer prices. One of the things that was also talked about that has gone away totally is something called ZPG. We totally forgot about ZPG. Zero population growth. It was not popular. There was only one country that made an attempt at something close to that, and that was China. But that's one thing that we have kind of politically totally put on the shelf as we have looked at the changes in world population and how we're going to feed that expanding population. And that population continues to increase. You've seen different graphs. And this is what's driving all the discussions in the symposia yesterday about Green Revolution 2 or Green Revolution 3.0, depending upon which speaker talks about where we are in that progression of events. A few years ago, Norman Borlaug delivered, I believe, his last presentation at ASA in New Orleans. And he basically said, by 2050, we will have to double food supply. Part of that will be increased expansion of irrigation. So now what we're going to do is we're going to throw in biofuel into the mix of food, fuel, and feed, and is there going to be enough water? So like any good college class, at the end class, there is going to be a test. It's going to be simple. It's going to be multiple choice, and these are the potential answers. So what I'd like you to do is think about with me the next few minutes and realize that what I'm going to take you on not necessarily is a destination, but a journey about water. And so we're going to talk about some big picture things in terms of U.S. crop acreage and yields. And then what I'd like to do is use Nebraska as a case study for a projection for the Great Plains. So most recent USDA figures, this is corn yield and corn acres up and up. Soybean yields increase up, acres up. Rice yields up, acreage about flat. Sorghum yields up somewhat, acreage down. Winter wheat yields up, acreage down. Cotton yields up, cotton acreage down generally. If we summarize that in a chart, basically the winners and losers in terms of acres have been corn, soybean, and rice at the expense of sorghum, wheat, and cotton. Crop yield increases pretty substantial for corn, soybeans, rice, and cotton, not as much for sorghum and wheat. What I think is interesting, if you just do a linear regression through those numbers and look at the slopes of those lines for all of those crops except sorghum and wheat, that number is a little bit above 1.6. That represents the improvements in breeding, better agronomics, and management that we have helped us keep pace with the food production that we have had. But when we look at total U.S. figures from NASS in terms of our rain-fed cropland in the last 30 years, we've had a significant decline. But we've had about a 10% increase in our irrigated acreage. In range and forest land, we've had also a significant decline, which luckily has kind of leveled off. So what's been happening to that land? Why the decreases? We keep building houses. When we look at total land in U.S. farms in the last 30 years, it's been a steady decline of about 10%. Now, let's look at energy, and there's a lot of euphoria about what energy crops are going to do for us and bioenergy. These are figures from the U.S. Energy Information Administration, and these are all the sources and our uses in terms of quadrillion BTUs until the year 2035. Right here, what we have is 2010. You see coal, nuclear, natural gas, liquids, renewables. And we have this great projection that biofuels will triple by 2030. And there they are. So it helped kind of focuses our thoughts on how much of a contribution bioenergy sources are going to make in the big picture of everything that we use. So if we think about biofuel crops in the context of current, you know, food, fiber, and feed, everybody's got a piece of the pie. What's happening with land resources? Are they increasing? Not. So if we're going to increase biofuels by triple, that little pie goes from 3 to 9. Somebody's piece of the pie gets smaller. Okay? So to avoid those problems and the whole food versus fuel debate, which I didn't include because there wasn't enough time, we essentially need a picture like this. We need a bigger pie, which means bigger slices. That means more land into production, which probably isn't going to happen. That means less land loss in terms of urban sprawl, less soil degradation. Our speaker at the Soil Science last night talked about that at the SSA Awards banquet. Higher crop yields is a part of that, more irrigated area. It's going to require government support to accomplish research, money, subsidies, and everybody likes more taxes, right? We'll see at the end of today whether that picture will change somewhat. But this is going to require political, scientific, and social action. That all takes time, and unfortunately, it's longer than most political lifetimes, and it's not very expedient, and a lot of politicians don't even want to look at it. So let's look at the Great Plains as an example area. Many times we talk about the High Plains. It's really just a subset. It's the higher, drier portions, but that's where a lot of the irrigation is that Tom talked about. I moved to North Platte, Nebraska in 1975. I'm a Colorado native. I grew up with an irrigation shovel in my hand. My dad, our farms are around Greeley, Colorado. I was enthralled with Michener's book, Centennial, and I loved the character Potato Brumbaugh, who made a diversion out of the South Platte River and grew potatoes. What they realized and what we still realize today in most of this area is that irrigation provides stability in that very dry climate. And as Tom mentioned, there's great precipitation change from the base of the Rockies to the eastern part of the Great Plains. Essentially, we go from about 12 inches of 300 millimeters to 600 at about Grand Island, Nebraska. The other thing that is always with us, though, is drought. We just came out of an 8-year drought in much of the High Plains region. It was longer than the drought of the 1930s. The severity of some of the years in there were as severe as the 1930s, but we didn't dry up and blow away, largely because of conservation cropping efforts and some things that we've learned in the last 50 years. So that recurring drought interspersed with seductive rainier periods are normal features of the Great Plains, as is true today as when Thornwaite quoted that in the Yearbook of Agriculture back in 1945. So let's look at Nebraska as a case study. We've heard about Nebraska and the Ogallala Aquifer today, so we'll talk about land, water, irrigation development constraints, and enhancing water use efficiency in terms of more crop per drop. In terms of soil resources, we have the very large area of true sandhills. This is mostly ranches. The panhandle is predominantly sandy soils, but the remaining portion of Nebraska primarily is a loess mantle over either sedimentary or glacial soils in the eastern part. Very good, deep, productive soils, no rocks. We look at our water resources. Our surface water irrigation projects in the state of Nebraska are highlighted in blue. We have about 1.2 million acres of surface irrigation with over 7 million that's groundwater, and the little black dots are the irrigation wells. And part of that reason is because we do have excellent saturated thickness in most of the Ogallala Aquifer. Ranges up to 1,000 feet in the central sandhills, but again, that's mostly ranches. There's not a lot of irrigation development and not a lot of cropping in that area. When we look at the complete High Plains Aquifer and we look at Nebraska and our seven relatives, we jokingly in Nebraska refer to it Nebraska and the Seven Dwarves, because Nebraska has 70% of the exploitable water in the High Plains Aquifer. And if you look at maps of groundwater decline from pre-development, this is the map for the High Plains in terms of the feet in decline up to, I think this is up to 2007. Shows one picture, shows that really Kansas on south, it looks pretty bad. But because of the differences in the saturated thickness of the aquifer, it looks even worse if you express that on a percentage basis. And again, extremely severe here in parts of Kansas, a little bit in eastern Colorado, some in the northern Texas panhandle, and especially the central Texas panhandle, where they're very severe declining water levels. You look at Nebraska and you say, wow, you guys are in great shape. Look at that map. There's not any of that red on there. But when you look at the state from our own data from our Conservation Survey Division, we have major areas of decline when you look at this with a little closer magnifying glass in the state. Some of those declines even occur in eastern Nebraska where we get 25, 26 inches of rainfall down here around Aurora, Nebraska, and these really good irrigated deep silt loam soils. Conversely, we have areas of groundwater inclines where the groundwater level in the last 50 years has increased 30 to 50 feet. Those are areas generally fed by surface water irrigation projects. So again, there are pluses and minuses. What the declining water resources has led to about 30 years ago was the creation of something called natural resource districts. Local entities elected, they have a tax base, they manage the groundwater resources. The State Department of Natural Resources manages the surface water resources. Until 2004, Nebraska law did not recognize that groundwater and surface water were hydrogeologically connected. Somehow the politicians figured that out, and now it is. We instituted lots of regulations starting in 2004, and essentially, the eastern third of Nebraska is the only part that is not under regulation of moratorium for surface water or groundwater. There will be no new development if there is any impact of surface water on groundwater and even limitations on groundwater development. So what we've got is what we have. So in 2004, we thought, boy, Nebraska, we're going to see a decline in sprinkler irrigation. So in 2005, we said, boy, those numbers are going to go down by 2010. What actually happened is in 2004, we had 88,000 registered wells, and last year, we had 95,000. In the areas where farmers could still do it, they did it because they knew the door was going to close. And that is basically what we're doing, is converting former rain-fed land to irrigated land, but that will also be ending. About 93% of that irrigated land is in corn and soybeans, both potential bioenergy crops, right? And what that increase did with some problems in California, it put Nebraska number one in terms of total irrigated acreage. Let's talk a little bit about water use efficiency and the blue and the blue-green. And this is just a curve of a yield versus evapotranspiration relationship for dry land for corn, 100th meridian, which runs through Cozad, Nebraska. And the yield versus ET line is straight. Basically, you have to evapotranspire a lot of water before you get your first kernel of corn. But then beyond that, that relationship is straight. The slope of that line, depending upon where you look in the literature, somewhere is between 8 or 9 bushels per acre inch up to 14 or even 15 bushels per acre inch. Whereas the relationship between yield and irrigation is curvilinear. There's a linear portion, we have a diminishing return, and then it flattens off. In the old days, we would have said this would have been a nice quadratic because it bent down with the newer hybrids, better nutrient use efficiency, better rooting, whatever. You can over-irrigate them, and this thing doesn't usually bend down. So when we look at the difference between the yield ET line and our yield versus irrigation line, that difference is really what we call the non-ET losses. And this is a fairly busy slide, but what we're looking at here is the yield versus ET and going from an inefficient to an efficient system. We essentially reduce some of those non-ET losses. Well, depending upon which side of the fence you're on, you look at this map differently. The water agency people look at this and say, oh, farmers are over here, and if they move back to here, they can have the same yield with less water, and that'll save us water. Farmers look at this and say, if I get more efficient, I can use the same amount of water and I can make more yield, which makes me more money. So it depends upon which side you want to argue of what your perception is of this graph. As we think about this picture of the blue-green revolution in terms of what we're looking at and the importance of the blue in the green revolution, what we really need to do is think about how we're going to change the slope of that yield versus ET line. And what we want to do is we want to move from over here somewhere over here. Now, in one regard, in terms of what Monsanto, Pioneer, all the companies are doing, when they talk about water use efficiency, you would think that this is what they're trying to do. Maybe, maybe not. I think until some good scientists, Tom, Terry, maybe myself, if I'm around that long, can look at those in a field situation and see, are we going to make this happen? I don't know. One of the ways to look at that is to look at some models. Ken Kassman, Haishun Yang, Achim Dobermann created a model a few years ago. It's an excellent predictor of yield for hybrid maize across the Corn Belt. What they did is they took a 20-year data set and simulated corn yields across the Western Corn Belt and looked at those yields versus ET. And what they essentially came out with, and this was published in 2009 by a paper by Grassini, Kassman, and a few others, was that the average water productivity for those simulations of that data was about 8 bushels per acre inch. The upper boundary over here was about 11. So it shows that with our current existing technology and hybrids, that's where we are. They looked at some of the research that's been done over in Nebraska. I feel pretty good about this because two of our data sets from North Platte are in here. I spent about 28 years there before I moved to Scotts Bluff. Some is Ken's high yield intensification work at Mead, the blue dots. Some is from Progressive Farmer Yields in eastern Nebraska. And this purple is the farm field winner of the corn contest. This is the 8 bushel per inch line. This is the 11 bushel per inch line. So it's possible for us with today's technology to get there to that upper boundary. So when we think about this, where are those improvements going to come to help us move and change that line? Well, in deference to all the plant breeders, and the good ones will say, we aren't going to do it all with genetics. Part of that movement will be with genetics, but there will be improvements that will move us up in that line in this direction. Those are going to be crop management improvements. Things that move us from over here to over here are going to be irrigation management improvements. So how does this look like in the real world? Does it play out? Ken took some data from the Tri-Basin NRD where they have to report water use. And one of the things that came with the NRDs in Nebraska is the water police are here, folks. In all of these areas, every farmer has a water meter. If you tamper with it, you lose your water pumping rights for 3 years. They don't mess with the water meters. Everybody is metered. We know how much is going out on all of these wells in Nebraska. What they did is looked at the water pumpage in this area, deep silt loam soils. These guys routinely, on center pivot basis, are producing 220 to 250 bushels per acre, 14 to 15 megagrams per hectare. If we take all of them and look at where they are on the two reference lines, here's the 11, here's the 8, this is the whole group. We divide it up. Here are the pivot irrigators. Here are the gravity irrigators. Can we make improvements? Very definitely. Real data from real farmers. And so basically, this is where we are. These are the pivot guys. These are the gravity guys. Just going from gravity to pivot will save water. If we can move them, this group over to this line in terms of this, what we look at in terms of simulated yields, we gain improvements. If we start practicing limited or deficit irrigation down here, we decrease water use more, but we do increase yield. But if we did that today in this area, we would save one third of the water that is currently being pumped to grow maize. And maize is a big deal in Nebraska. Somebody talked about the 25% of corn in Illinois that goes to ethanol. Of our 9 million acres of corn in Nebraska, 50% of it right now goes for ethanol production. It works well because it's integrated with the livestock industry. We have a nice cycle. So, as you think about it, in the future, we think about biofuel opportunities. Will there be enough water? I guess you can come up with your own answer. But when we think about this in terms of the Great Plains, if we look at land resources for the future, we probably have that as a plus. We probably can develop some additional land. In terms of water resources, that supply is probably going to be limited, as you've seen from the previous talks. Irrigation development in your area is going to be a positive or negative, depends upon the constraints. In one of the states with most of the water, we're seeing constraints. So really those enhancements are going to have to come from enhanced water use efficiency in terms of crop soil management improvements, irrigation, and also hybrids. Now, I haven't said anything about livestock. Tom mentioned something about it, but even in the panhandle of Nebraska, and it's reflective of what goes on in the Great Plains, even though we make lots of money from crops, we make more from livestock. And in deference to the billion ton report, at least in the Great Plains, there's not a lot of extra biomass out there that's going to be cheap to go for cellulosic ethanol, because we have cellulosic plants right now. They're requiring most of that cellulose. So, like Larry the Cable Guy says, how are we going to get her done? Research, education, demonstration, promotion. And one thing I never would have said in my earlier years, but after 35 years of watching NRD's work in Nebraska, it's also going to take regulation. To do that, however, there will be barriers and solutions. We're working. Agriculture is about culture. The average age of U.S. farmers is 57. Some places there's old habits, traditions. A lot of it's perception by landlords, bankers, neighbors. But again, the solutions will be hopefully education and some things that we can do well. With that, I think there is a bright future. I think we'll have enough water, but it is going to require some amazing pioneering efforts in the future, just like we had the pioneering efforts in the past. Thank you. Bob. The 11 bushel threshold is kind of where we are now. There are other experiments that have been done that shown that you can actually, the slope of that line is more like 12 or 13. But in terms of the modeling efforts and some of the work that's out there right now in the data sets that Ken Kassman has looked at, that 11 is kind of a current upper threshold without better germplasm. It can be higher than that. The slope, the one graph on the yield versus ET, maybe could have redrawn it differently. A lot of the work on the yield ET lines on corn say, 9 to 10 inches before you of ET before you get your first bushel of corn. Something around there. It's probably more than five. The five is probably optimistic. And got to realize that the model with the five was generated. You know, as somebody said, models are useful, but they're not correct.